Grow CFO is where finance leaders grow together. Join thousands of like-minded professionals using Grow CFO to access the combined knowledge and experience of the finance leader community. You can join us today at growcfo.net. Hello, and welcome to the Grow CFO Show. I'm your host, Kevin Appleby. And today, we're starting the first of a three-part series. We're going to be talking about scaling FP&A. Now, throughout this three-part series, I'm going to be joined by Catherine Marks. Now, Catherine, you'll have seen on the podcast before. Catherine runs our FP&A bootcamps in Europe. So Catherine has a great background in FP&A. So between us, we're going to be inviting various guests on in the next three episodes to talk about all sorts of different aspects of scaling FP&A. Catherine, tell us some more about what we're going to do.
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, it's great to be diving into this three-part series. And today we're going to be talking about building the team. So how do we think about evolving our FP&A team to support a rapidly growing business? And how do we address the people challenges associated with that? I'm delighted today that we're going to be joined by Jane Riley from Xander. So Jane has been in the London finance recruitment scene since 2008. For the past 3 years at Xander, she's been focused on connecting top finance talent with venture capital and private equity-backed tech startups and scale-ups that are seeking to build best-in-class finance functions. Jane's portfolio spans a range of roles from financial controllers and heads of finance, FP&A, group controllers, FDs, and CFOs. And she's built an incredible network over the past decade, creating valuable partnerships that support the learning and development of her candidates and address the needs of her clients. We've worked together now for a number of years, and Jane is extremely well-versed in the needs of a growing FP&A team. So hi, Jane. Welcome. Glad that you could join us today.
Thanks, Catherine.
Definitely, Jane. Welcome to the show. But Catherine, you mentioned that the first part of this series is on building the team. What's going to come up in parts two and three?
Part two is going to be on getting the infrastructure right. So we're going to be talking all about systems and processes and how we should think about those as we get bigger. And then we're going to be talking about navigating an acquisition. So what's firstly the value that FP&A can bring to a transaction? And then how do we navigate integrating finance teams, something I've been through a couple of times myself and presents a number of challenges. So we're going to go through the full business life cycle from scale up through to an exit process.
So next week, watch out for our guest is going to be the FP&A guy, Paul Barnhurst, talking systems. And in that final episode, we're actually bringing together the big FP&A team that Catherine was part of going through a very big merger. So that's going to be fun. But anyway, back to this episode and talking scaling FP&A and talking people. So Jane, just thinking about that organization's very first dedicated FP&A hire. Back in the webinar that we ran on scaling a few weeks ago, we talked about hiring somebody with a few years experience behind them so they know how it all works. What do you think we ought to be looking for in the first hire?
Yeah, it's a good question, Kevin. And I think a lot of businesses that we speak to when they're looking at hiring their first FP&A person, they haven't necessarily had kind of the rigor or the kind of controls around FP&A. And so they're looking for somebody that can come in and roll their sleeves up and get stuck in and is able to implement some processes and structure around the FP&A piece. Particularly, I guess the CFO is looking for somebody that can bring in the accuracy around budgeting and that someone that can build and own the budget, but also someone that can own the financial plan and carry out that regular forecasting against the plan and really own that financial model. I think that's crucial for anybody coming in as a first finance hire for FP&A. Typically, that's what we see CFOs looking at so they can take on and own that piece and really manage it so that I guess it has a dedicated focus and it gives the business comfortability in the numbers and the accuracy that so they can hold themselves to account and really, I guess, kind of follow and track their progress as they hopefully scale. And it's really keeping up to date with the investor and the board's expectations. And I guess being able to pull that through the clarity of numbers and having comfortability, because without the budget, there's no real kind of grounding for the business. So it's that kind of stake to start and enable the business to kind of grow from there.
So, Catherine, just expanding on that a little bit, we're talking there about bringing in a dedicated FP&A person. I guess a company, though, has to have a certain level of funds to be able to do that. Do you think that's always the case, that you bring in a dedicated person, or is it part of a person in your experience?
It's a great question. I think on the whole, I would err on the side of early and bringing in that dedicated person. To some extent, you can't afford not to. But that said, that initial hire is going to be quite a generalist, working quite dynamically, responding to changes in the business and market environment, and also might initially have some accounting responsibilities as well. And at a certain point, those can start to fall away, and that person, that team as we build, will become more focused on business partnering.
So tell me a little bit more about how that's going to evolve.
Yeah. So in your early days, priorities are going to be around cash flow, funding requirements. Then we start to build forecasting, performance insight, analyzing the financial impact of key decisions, the path to profitability, and moving towards more established processes with regular meetings with stakeholders. Actually, in the webinar that we did, Christian had a great way of framing this, which I'm going to borrow. He talked about strategic orientation, resource allocation, and data. So just to touch on those briefly, strategic orientation means a startup will be focused on more immediate tactical matters. But as we grow, we need to start to switch our attention to more strategic work. In terms of that second point, resource allocation, earlier on, we're thinking about making sure that we really understand our runway. But as we grow, we're thinking more and more about the best allocation of resources, thinking about the return on investment for different options. And then lastly, data. When we start out, we have more limited data, and it's more about making sure that what we have is accurate and timely. As we grow, we have a lot more data to play with, probably too much data, and our role is more then to navigate what's most important.
So what does that mean in terms of team size and structure?
Yeah, great question. And there's really no one-size-fits-all approach. It's very unique to your business. One or two people, as I mentioned, they might also have accounting responsibilities, and then move to perhaps three or four, where business partnering becomes more of the focus. And as we grow, we have to start to think more about generalization versus specialization in terms of how we structure that team. I would think primarily along two lines: alignment with the business and or alignment with support functions. So, for example, does it make sense to have one person dedicated to people-related costs as a partner into the people function, who then supports others in the FP&A team with discussions with their partners in marketing or technology, which is going to cut across both people and non-people costs? And then if you're a little bit bigger, you might think about geography as well. If you're a larger organization, but perhaps with smaller markets to serve, for example, you might have one person in the team who partners with the business in that country. It all depends on the strategic importance of different markets for you. And above all, just make sure that it makes sense for your organization's strategy and structure. Keep in mind where you're going as a business over the next 1 to 3 years, and what's the FP&A team that you're going to need in place to support that.
So there must be some people challenges in all of that, Catherine. Now, you've done this a few times now. So what are the kind of big challenges you've come across?
Oh, plenty of challenges. I guess the first point is that it can be a really volatile environment. And that doesn't necessarily suit everybody, or it can leave people feeling confused or demotivated. I think as leaders, we can help by being an anchor, by helping people to see the big picture, give them as much clarity as possible, whilst acknowledging that it's a journey, things are changing, and being transparent that you don't have all of the answers all of the time. I think when a business experiences rapid change, often the infrastructure doesn't quite keep up. And especially when there's then a major event, maybe it's acquired by another bigger organization, you're forced to take a step change. But people can be reluctant to let go of the way that they've done things in the past, or perhaps the fit just isn't right anymore, which can lead to a period of instability and high turnover, both within the FP&A and wider finance team and the wider organization itself. And then particularly thinking more to Jane's world, finding the right people can be a real challenge. Recruiting the kind of people who'll thrive in an environment of high growth and a lot of change, and also good finance talent is in really high demand. And then we've got to retain them.
Yeah, but I guess as well that the sort of skills that you can see in a good FP&A person are probably the widest set of skills as anywhere in the finance team. You can say, you've got to be good at organizing, processing, and cleaning data. You've got to be good at drawing out the stories and the lessons from that data. You've then got to be good at communicating those things to the rest of the business. So you've got to be a darn good storyteller, and you've got to be a business partner. And that is one very wide set of skills. So, and Jane, just thinking about that, what Catherine touched on, the challenges in recruiting. What do you see as the challenge in recruiting great FP&A people?
Yeah, it's one of those things, I guess, with the skills that you've mentioned, it's really broad, and it is. It touches a lot of different areas of the business. And I think a lot of people that we work with, when they're looking for somebody from FP&A, their ideal is that they have someone that's done it or seen it previously, where they've been into a business where the data maybe isn't perfect or isn't accurate. And they want somebody that's seen that, is comfortable in that environment, and is happy getting stuck in and getting their business and their data in a place where they're able to produce those accurate reports and really see the whole thing through to hopefully what is a best-in-class FP&A function. And I guess the thing with that is it comes at a price, and there are budgetary constraints for some businesses that they can't always necessarily afford what they need to be looking at for those individuals. And also a lot of those people don't necessarily want to go and do exactly the same thing again. They're looking for slightly more breadth, or they're potentially thinking long term they'd like to be a CFO. So a lot of conversations we have with people are, I've done FP&A, but I'd love to be a CFO. What I need to do to bridge the gap? And I think that's one of the interesting areas and the challenges in hiring in this is, if you have the budgetary constraints, it might be worthwhile looking at somebody that has done FP&A, but maybe hasn't done everything and led everything as a number one. So it gives them the opportunity to learn and progress. Or if you do have the budget to hire somebody that has been there and has the experience of seeing it, being able to offer them some breadth to the role or potential progression, or once the FP&A is built and running smoothly, that they could be a, not necessarily a successor to the CFO, but to be able to take on more from that individual to, I guess, broaden their skill set and offer another dimension to what is a typically kind of pure FP&A role and remit. So I think they're the biggest kind of challenges that we see when hiring. It's just kind of managing and aligning those kind of expectations.
Yeah, and I must admit that I see companies all the time wanting somebody who is an exact fit to their profile, has done it all before. I suppose increasingly, as I look at these things, say, well, hang on, now that's possibly the wrong approach to take, because if you recruit the finished article into this role, where's that person going to grow? I'd rather have somebody that perhaps had 50 to 60% of what I'd written on the piece of paper, and clearly show the ability to grow and the want to grow, than that complete item. Because probably that person is complete to my spec there. But as you said, they'll be saying, well, where's my CFO role coming from? I want to progress. Jane, so what can companies do to attract the best talent?
Yeah, so I think touching upon what we've just mentioned really around offering that kind of variety and the breadth and thinking of you know, what you're offering that individual when they come on board. And really, it's being able to offer that progression, offer the opportunity to deliver on projects and to be involved with things that may be outside of their day-to-day remit. Everybody likes to feel that they are adding value, or they've achieved something, or that they've made something more efficient. So it's giving them the kind of autonomy and the responsibility to be involved in those projects and other kind of ideas that might be happening in the business that they can support and I guess help out. The common ones are things like training and development and the team culture, and you hear those a lot. But I think as long as you're offering that opportunity for kind of breadth and progression and the ability to have the autonomy and add value, that is crucial. Salary always comes up, and benefit packages. Maybe less so now, but I think it's still prominent. And we're actually in the process of releasing our salary guide. So there's a resource there if it's of interest to anyone. But I think another thing that comes up with FP&A that we don't always see with other hires is case studies. So I guess the ability to showcase kind of your modeling ability or your Excel ability that you maybe wouldn't necessarily have to showcase in another finance role or capacity. And so I think it's looking at how you can streamline that hiring process. And we, you know, support with that to make sure that you are managing the expectations and the stages. And I think if you do put a case study as part of a process, it's not only for the candidate or potential candidate to have visibility of kind of numbers and get a feel for kind of the stakeholders and what those numbers may look like, but also for you to be able to assess that individual and how they maybe interpret data, present data, and how they maybe come across it from a challenge. So it's a kind of two-way exercise. And I think that's really crucial not to forget that it's not just a kind of exercise on their behalf, but it kind of works both ways. So they have comfortability as to what they may be coming into.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned salary. And yeah. I'm just minded with all of this that salary or money generally isn't the thing that motivates people. So is it true that as far as salary is concerned, you should be paying the rate that takes money off the table, but the real thing that you're going to use to attract somebody to you is the other things that you're going to ask them to do?
I think it's a balance. At the end of the day, everyone has their, I guess, kind of value and their worth. And people I work with, no one really wants to take a pay cut. Sometimes people will move for a parallel salary if they feel that the role is going to give them another dimension or something they haven't done previously. But I think if the role is replicating a large portion of what they've done, or there's potential risk element with the business as to how quickly it might scale or what that might look like, then usually salary does come into play, particularly around the benefit package, whether it might be equity or bonus, to make sure that is competitive. So it's not just base salary, but the entire package that comes with it. Things like pension contributions or healthcare or annual leave, they are hugely important to individuals, particularly if they're used to having things like unlimited annual leave or quite a good healthcare package for their family. And it's just making sure that they're comparable and like for like. So I think that has to be taken into account. But you're right, the actual role and what that role will offer them from a kind of project, from an exposure to stakeholders, from a what's the growth story of the business and what's their plan and what can they own, that has a huge part to play as how much value they think they'll be able to bring, and also what that will do to their own kind of personal skill set and development.
Brilliant. So we've learned so far that this is a tough market. There's lots and lots of demand to get people. We're certainly going to have to pay the going rate. We're going to have to pay people the value that they know they're worth. We're going to have to offer them some real challenge to get them to move. So, Catherine, having gone through this minefield of a process to actually hire someone, they've arrived. What are we going to do to nurture them, keep them, grow them?
Yeah, we've only one part of the battle, right? So thinking back on some of the challenges that I was talking about, and Jane also mentioned creating the right culture. I think it's really important. You'll have your broader organization values, of course, but think about what they mean in the context of finance and FP&A specifically. Make sure that the team know that the door's always open and they can talk to you. I used to say to my teams that if I didn't know what was in their head, then I couldn't do anything about it. I think it's really important to create a culture of psychological safety. So what I mean by that is a safe space characterized by trust and your team feeling able to speak up with ideas, questions, concerns, mistakes, which is actually one of the things we talk about on the FP&A bootcamp. But folks are interested, then have a look for Google's Project Aristotle, where they found that to be the number one most important factor in high performing teams. And I think it's really important that your team are part of shaping the FP&A vision and evolution. Everyone's got a part to play in that, so get their inputs and make sure everyone's clear on what they're doing. And invest in their development. Spend time understanding their strengths, their ambitions, and how you can support them to get there and to address any skills gaps. I think going back to some of the things that Jane was talking about, that's a key thing that's going to differentiate us as an attractive organization to work for. Of course, as we were talking about, there's a financial reward to consider, and we need to know how we benchmark against others, but that only goes so far.
But Jane, we're talking skills. What are the most critical skills for an FP&A role?
So I know we touched upon it earlier, you know, it's a huge breadth that comes with FP&A, but I think that a few kind of standout points for me, it's really to be able to understand your key stakeholders, you know, understand what their challenges are, what they are needing from you, what the business is needing, but also what they want. So it's that balance between kind of understanding those two dynamics, understanding the key metrics of the business, and really almost being able to live and breathe those metrics, really relate to your stakeholders and almost preempt what they might need or what they maybe don't realize they need yet. And then being able to understand how best to present that data for them. So is it graphs? Is it tables? Are you utilizing Power BI? Are you building different dashboards? So it's then being able to work out what way to present that data and what works best for your audience. So it's understanding, then working out how best to present it, and really then being able to support them with their strategic decisions. Because I think if they're not utilizing it, then it's pointless. So I think it's really being able to understand, grasp, and then hopefully support them through the decisions that they're having to make on the back of the information that you're providing. So they'd be kind of my main kind of couple of points on it.
So Catherine, how do we develop those skills?
Yeah, great question, given how broad those FP&A skills are. I tend to see this, or the skills, on three different levels, aligned with the way that we think about the Grow CFO competency framework models, where we talk about foundation, implementation, and impact skills. So in the base layer, you have the more technical skills, the core skill sets we need as the basis for building our credibility and influence. Then that implementation layer is about how we deliver, particularly further developing our business partnering skills, our abilities to drive change. And then the impact skills, and mastering those is how we become great FP&A leaders. And I think we can develop through those three levels in different ways. I really think about it in four buckets. So the first being direct on the job learning. So a great way to learn is by doing and learning from others around us. It's really important also that we take time to reflect on our learnings and the bigger picture of why we're doing things in a certain way. So encourage curiosity in your teams. I think then complementary to that is training courses like those that we offer at Grow CFO. For example, we have an FP&A bootcamp, which teaches core FP&A skills, and a business partnering bootcamp, which takes those skills to the next level, amongst several others. And what's important then is to make sure that we apply those tools and techniques that we've learned so that we put them into practice straight away. Third, I'm thinking about broadening skill sets. So as Jane was talking about earlier, finding opportunities within FP&A or the wider finance team to get involved with projects. It might be a systems implementation. It might be revisiting our processes, continually improving things. And then finally, there's what I'll call indirect learning. So other opportunities within your organization that aren't just working on a financial model or doing a particular piece of analysis, but mentoring, for example, or working on a project which is not directly related to finance. And ultimately, that could also be facilitating moves within your business. We'll, of course, become much better business partners by undertaking a secondment outside of finance itself.
Well, one thing you mentioned there, Catherine, was the right at the beginning was the skills assessment, the FP&A skills assessment. Now, if you're a finance leader listening to this and you want to assess your FP&A team, or you're an FP&A professional and you want to say, how do my skills stack up against the rest of the community? So you can go to the Grow CFO website and you can go in, you can answer 45 questions. We're identifying 45 different skills within FP&A, and you can get a PDF report back that gives you your score against your peer group score and can show you where your development gaps are and start you down, or your team's route down this learning track that Catherine's just been talking about. So we'll make sure there's a link to the competency framework in the show notes. But Jane, what makes a great FP&A leader?
Yeah, so I think it's someone that can really, as I said earlier, immerse themselves in the business, and someone that can build those relationships and have that credibility with the senior leadership team and really build that rigor and the structure around the reporting, ensuring that there's your visibility and kind of accuracy in the numbers. And I guess really they are the voice of the business internally. So it's, I hear, you know, time to get around layman terms, and it's just being able to build those relationships and actually talk at a level where everyone understands what's going on. And it really, you then get that buy-in and hopefully you have more of those kind of open, honest conversations internally that will only add to you as you progress. But I think fundamentally, you have to be able to present data that is accurate and reliable. Otherwise, you will lose all credibility. So I think that's the kind of crux of it. And then hopefully the business will be able to make decisions on the back of it. And you've done a good job if you're leaving a legacy. So if you're able to sit back at the end of the day and say, I've built a team around me and they are all growing and developing, and I'm in a role that I'm growing and developing in, and it's that self-fulfilling kind of prophecy. So I think you need to be able to kind of leave that in a good place and be able to step back and think everyone is doing a brilliant job and the business are kind of listening to what we're presenting and saying. So there would be my thoughts on it.
Catherine, you've been in that position on a number of occasions as FP&A leader. Is there anything you'd add to those things?
Well, I absolutely agree with everything that Jane's just said. Really, it's about driving action, understanding the industry, the business, having those relationships beyond the numbers. But I guess what I'd add, the crux of it is a great FP&A leader is a master of balance, striking the balance between the big picture, jumping into the detail where needed, navigating the tricky role of building great relationships and being that trusted advisor, but also being the voice of reason and having to say no sometimes. If you're working with a shareholder, again, finding that right balance between the relationship and transparency, but retaining autonomy and sometimes having to push back on requirements. You've got to have really strong emotional intelligence and impact skills. It's a challenging role, also a really privileged one where you're going to learn a lot. So highly recommend it.
So it's a challenging role. We've learned that people with these skills are in great demand. We've learned that they're hard to recruit. We've learned that once we've got them into the organization, we've got to take a lot of time developing them, improving them, making sure the challenge is there. But folk do leave. So Jane, what tends to be the reason that we lose these great people that we've hired?
So there's a couple of themes that tend to crop up. And the first one is if they don't feel they're necessarily getting buy-in from the business. So if for whatever reason they don't feel that the business is really listening to the kind of their numbers or their suggestions, or they're not really open to having those conversations, it can be a frustration on many people's parts. So unfortunately, that is one area. I'd say the most common one is probably that they don't feel the team is being built around them as promised. So we touched at the beginning, first FP&A hire, what does that look like? But usually within kind of 6 to 12 months, they would be looking at bringing an individual in to support them. And I think if that doesn't materialize for budgetary reasons or whatever the reason may be, it can make that individual feel like they're still in the detail and in the data, and they're not able to step out and build the more credible relationships and make those commercial decisions that they are probably wanting to be involved in. And I think if they're still stuck in the day-to-day detail, that is a big kind of area that people just feel that they're not able to add value and they're not able to progress. So that's probably the biggest reason. You do hear of things like salary or culture, if it's just not aligned for whatever reason, that does come up every now and again. And I think another one that comes up, and it's usually as the company scales, I think if they've come into a role originally that's quite broad, and we said earlier, Catherine said about the breadth of FP&A, and maybe they might get involved with other finance responsibilities. I think if the business scales and ends up separating out FP&A and control at that point, and their role becomes purely FP&A focused, sometimes people might leave then because they feel like they don't have the breadth and the oversight that they once had. That would be another kind of reason for structural changes as the business scales, and they maybe segregate duties in a different way. But they're the main ones that we see.
We talked there largely negative reasons for moving on. How often do you see the positive reason that somebody's been offered a bigger, better role, or perhaps the step on that first rung of the CFO ladder?
Yeah, so I guess because of the role that I do, people are coming to me usually because they are looking for a kind of new role or a new kind of remit, and they would be their reasons that they would come to me and say, can we help? People definitely get approached about opportunities for them to step up and take on more, especially actually if they've been in a large organization and want to step into a startup or a smaller business, then they can make that transition across quite easily. And it gives them something new to learn and a new challenge. So you'll see that transition happening. And you'll also see if people have made a success of a business and FP&A has, you know, been hugely valuable, then they may be coached or approached by another organization to replicate and do something similar for them. But it may offer more breadth to the role and hopefully will allow them to be a CFO or kind of a successor to a CFO. So there definitely are positive stories out there. I guess just typically as a nature of kind of the remit I do, usually people are coming to me to say, can you help? But yeah, that they are there.
So in terms of routes to CFO, would you say that the FP&A route to CFO is the commonest, or is it something else?
I wouldn't say it's the commonest. I would say usually the most common route is if you become an FC or head of finance and then you are transitioning into CFO that way. Yeah. So what you'll see typically is if people have done FP&A, they will transition into more kind of broader FD or head of finance role. They may not be a pure FC because of it's typically more control focused. So they usually will come in at kind of head of finance FD, and then there'll be a successor to a CFO depending on the size and the complexity of the business. You don't usually go straight from FP&A to CFO. You want to really try and get the oversight of the entire function. And then once you've got that and you've got that kind of comfortability, then it's stepping up into the CFO role.
Catherine, we don't want to stand in people's way if they're going on to bigger and better things. But thinking about all those initial reasons that Jane talked about, there must be lots of things we can do to mitigate against folk going because they're just not happy with the role.
Yeah, I think remembering back to your first point, Jane, which was about the business not listening to them. If that's the case for anyone, then I'd love to talk to you about what we can do to help.
Well, I'm sure we can all have long drinks over a coffee or a beer or whatever. All the times the business didn't listen.
Well, yes. And sometimes some things that we have to accept, but there's also lots of tools and techniques we can learn to help. But then, yeah, thinking on some of those other points, the team not building as expected, don't be too short-sighted. I know it can always be difficult to build the case for support functions. No one wants to invest more and more money. You need to build that business case and demonstrate the value that FP&A can bring. We talked a bit earlier about building the right kind of a finance team culture and investing in your team's development. And I would also say, make sure that the opportunities within your organization are clear to them. Taking on those new responsibilities, there's always going to be new things in a growing organization, whether that's within FP&A, within finance, or outside. And I guess ultimately, sometimes we do have to accept that it's the right thing for them to do, in which case, celebrate the time that they've been there, recognize their achievements, and stay in touch. Positive alumni also reinforce that team culture, and you never know where you're going to cross paths again. Sometimes people return to organizations in a different capacity. Stranger things have happened. So yeah, in any case, finish strongly and don't burn bridges.
Absolutely. I completely second that. Don't burn bridges. I can think of opportunities that have opened up for me personally by keeping in touch with people that I worked with maybe 15 or 20 years previously. Always keep that network warm, whether you're the employer and you've lost a key employee to something else, or you're the employee and you keep in touch with your peers or even your managers. Relationships, what goes around comes around. So, Jane, we're back on the recruitment scene here. People will have been listening to this, be thinking about recruiting FP&A folk, or may even be FP&A folk looking for the next opportunity. How do folk get in touch with you?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find my details there or for Xander, but by all means, have a look and send me a message and connect, and I'm happy to have a conversation. So yeah, by all means, have a look and send me a message.
Brilliant. And Xander are very good. Must point out, other agencies are available. In true BBC style. So, Catherine, we've talked a lot about what we do in developing FP&A folk in Grow CFO. So how can people reach out to you in particular?
Yeah, I love to chat about developing your team's finance skills. So yeah, please reach out to me. So either via Catherine Marks or my Grow CFO email, catherine.marks@growcfo.net. Or if you can't find either of those things, there is a contact form on the Grow CFO website. So if you drop a note there, it will find its way to me, and I would love to chat.
And once again, we'll put all of those contact details in the show notes. So just go and have a look at the notes to this episode if you want to follow up on anything, either with Jane, with Catherine, or with myself. Ladies, that has been a brilliant episode looking at how to scale FP&A from a people point of view. Jane, thank you hugely for being our guest. And Catherine, really looking forward to parts 2 and 3 and see where this goes.
Me too. Thanks, Kevin.